Welcome to the Local Brown Bagger, Tuesdays here on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Now, it is my very great pleasure to welcome Baroness Susan Greenfield, our speaker for this evening. She is professor of pharmacology at Oxford University, who has worldwide recognition for her research into our understanding of brain functions and disorders such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's diseases. And she has also been a leading researcher into the physical basis of consciousness. She holds 28 honorary degrees from universities in Britain and many other countries. And she is currently the director, and I believe the first woman director, of the Royal Institute of Great Britain. She published her own theory of consciousness, Journey to the Centers of the Mind, in 1995, followed by The Private Life of the Brain, published by Penguin 5 years later. It's the Vancouver Institute's enormous pleasure to have such a distinguished speaker with us tonight, and I will now ask Lady Greenfield to speak to us on the topic, which also is the title of her latest book, Tomorrow's People, How 21st Century Technology is Changing the Way We Think and Feel. Susan Greenfield.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a huge honor and pleasure to be here. It's a very exciting time to be alive, or it could be a very frightening time to be alive. And what we're going to look at this evening, and the reason that so many people are here, is I think we're going to ask questions that aren't really just concerning science, but to anyone who's going to be a citizen of the 21st century. And this is what I thought was very funny about being a thinker in residence, but actually I didn't do much thinking because they worked me so hard. But it was a wonderful scheme where you bring in people from outside to sort of have insights into issues perhaps where you can't normally see the wood for the trees. And it is a bit, I suppose, like that here, where we really need to stand back and see where are we going as a society, what do we want society to be, what do we want our kids to be. What kind of lives we want to live. These are huge questions that really can be subsumed under the issue of tomorrow's people. So what we're going to do is to see how far this spectre might actually be the case, because I bet you there's many people in this room who are not scientists who feel that science is going this way. Science is the dysfunctional nerd. Scientists are the people that are going to either take over the world or be bereft of any emotions sitting in the silos of their universities. Is this what your children and your grandchildren are going to look like, therefore, once the evil scientist has got hold of them? Well, that's what we're going to look at this evening. And what we're going to do is answer various questions. They're all appertaining, really, to this issue here, as shown by one of my heroes, George Bernard Shaw. And I don't know whether you know or like George Bernard Shaw or his writings, but I'm sure you'll agree, this is a really interesting picture. Wouldn't it be nice to be like this when one gets to that age? You can just see he looks really alert. There's something exciting going on behind those piercing eyes, of which the writings were only just a pale echo of the marvellous experience it must have been to have been George Bernard Shaw. The marvellous experience that it is to be you. And I don't know if you know the people you're sitting next to, but if you do know them, you might even love them, however close you are to them, they won't know firsthand what it's like to be you. They can't hack into your head and see the world through your piercing eyes. Well, perhaps you haven't got piercing eyes, but they can't see the world through your eyes in the same way. And it's this wonderful, unique take on the world that we prize so much, isn't it? This is the one thing we fear with dementia and Alzheimer's. This is something that really we prize more than anything else, however many ravages there might be to our body, whether we have to have organ transplants and the like. The thing we fear most is losing our identity. The thing we want to protect most, we treasure most, is our identity. It's a wonderful thing about being you, and that's why I showed you this picture, because pictures are supposed to speak 1,000 words. So what we're going to do, and I'll give you a summary now in case you want to doze off during the talk, we're going to ask a series of questions, and they will conveniently have summaries in red at the end of each section, so you can nudge each other if you want to get it. So we're going to, so each area has a little question to it. So we're going to look at lifestyle, what we're going to see as reality. We're going to look at robots, what do we think of our bodies. We're going to think about work, what we're going to do with our time. We're going to look at reproduction, not sex, I'm afraid, reproduction, and you'll see that they're separate. And that's going to be how they are, they'll be separate in the future. How are we going to view life? Education? What are we going to need to learn? Might seem obvious, but on the other hand, perhaps not. And then human nature, finally. What hopes for the future, as I've just been saying. So these are the six areas, and we've got just under, how long have we got, Chairman? About 50 minutes? 55 minutes? So that gives us about 5 to 10 minutes each one, yeah? To sort out each of these each of these issues. So let's see how fast we can go. I do apologise in advance for speaking quickly. I don't know I do, it's just everyone tells me I do. So I do apologise, but like being colourblind when you don't know that you are, but you have to say that you are. Okay, so lifestyle, what we're going to see is reality. Well, okay, let's start off rather banal. Let's imagine you're waking up quite soon and you go to the bathroom and you clean your teeth with this toothbrush and it, or indeed the mirror, speaks to you and it says, if you carry on like this, you're going to lose all your teeth in 10 years' time. You've got gum disease. Perhaps a little depressed, you then urinate in this strange-looking lavatory pan, and that speaks to you as well. And it says, you better get yourself checked out. You could have diabetes. And this might sort of be a bit depressing, going to the bathroom nowadays. But the whole issue is that already in development, and I should add, all the technologies I'm going to talk about, two things. One is I don't necessarily think they're good. I'm not necessarily endorsing them. I'm just presenting them to you. And the other issue is that they are in development already. We are not going to talk about time travel or black holes or anything amazing or science fiction. What we're going to talk about are things that already are in development so that you can evaluate, not me, you, collectively, we as a society can evaluate whether we want them or not. So this is the first issue then, a world where instead of having inert objects around you, you have objects that answer back. You have things that think around you, things that seem to detect what's going on in your body, what you're feeling, and to make adjustments accordingly. This will have huge advantages because, as we've seen, it would give you early warning for various health issues, but it would also mean that people would have third-party access to bits of your body and to things that were going on in a way that at the moment is not the case. At the moment we feel sort of exclusive. Imagine going on and logging onto your computer and it looking like this. And this is a computer that is designed to register the 14 points on your face that will convey the emotions you are feeling. It then will configure its face back. It's not conscious at all, of course, it's all software. It will configure its face to empathize with you. We hope empathize. And it will be voice interfacing, and so you'll say, hello, computer, or you might call it something else. And it will say, hello, you've just lost all your files, ha, 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 something. And then you might want to bash it even more than you do most computers, including the ones we've just been wrestling with here. The whole point being that you'll have voice interfacing and you'll have devices with human personas so that although you know, and of course you know, that they're not real, soon that will start to blur a little bit. Soon we'll start to take for granted things that are not living, having such amazing interactive abilities that even though they're not conscious, that's another issue we could discuss in the Q&A, nonetheless it will start to blur the line between real life and innate objects. And imagine having, as we all do, cups of coffee, talking. Soon that will change as well. As more and more we enter into a cyber world, already we see many people on their cell phones ignoring the people around them, ignoring the press of the real moment, but out there somewhere else. Where are you in cyberspace when you're on your cell phone? Where's your focus of attention? Where's your vision? It's certainly not in front of you because you're oblivious usually. People are oblivious to what's going on around them. So it fascinates me a lot as somehow going out of the present moment, still being conscious, but being connected in some sort of cyber world. And just to extend that, I don't know how many people are familiar with Second Life. I was at a conference in Edmonton when I mentioned it, and surprisingly few people had actually become familiar with another cyber reality. So it's not just a reality of being on your phone, but this is a reality where you can actually enter into a whole new world. This is not a computer game. This is a new way of life, as its name suggests. And I'm now going to show you a clip of Second Life.
If the bustling city is where you want to be, hit the market or the local bar with new friends. But if you prefer adventure, why don't you explore the wilderness or hunt animals? Build communities together, share special moments, maybe you even find love.
There you go. Maybe you'll even find love. So this is already, many people are already spending most of their lives playing Second Life. The Swedish embassy has already, it's the first country, Sweden, to open an embassy in Second Life. True. It's true. Please believe me. It's true. There is a currency in Second Life, their own monetary currency. Yeah. And apparently people are starting, you know, to give up their jobs or lose their jobs or their spouses because they've become Vlad the Dragon Slayer and things like this. Yeah. So this is, people are adopting identities called avatars. And this is becoming something that, certainly with younger people, is becoming an alternative to the real world. So let's summarise now. I told you it was going to be very brief in each case. You can nudge your neighbour awake now because they're going to get the summary. What's the future lifestyle? We'll have appliances with human interface personas, augmented reality, that's to say Second Life, or as you're going around, you'll have additional information about the world around you, like via your toothbrush. Body processes and the spoken word will influence the environment. Voice interface computing, body temperature, movements, facial expressions will change things around you. And therefore, this is the conclusion in red, emerging of the cyber world with reality. Now notice, I've put reality in inverted commas, because I'm sure there's some philosophers in the audience who would query, what is reality anyway? And let's not go there this evening. So discussing that. I've got another 80 slides to get through. You might not want to talk about reality just yet. But you can see that already our notion of reality and our notion how it's been for millennia, for ever since human beings have walked the planet, that somehow that might be challenged by this very pervasive technology, which is very different from technologies. When I normally talk about this, people say, oh, what about television? It's not like television, as you can see. It's highly interactive, it's highly invasive, and it's highly pervasive. Let's move on to robots, because obviously if we're thinking about technology in this way, then it leads on to robotics. Is this what your children or grandchildren are going to look like? This was from the cover of Newsweek a year or two ago. And the issue here is not so much robots. We're not talking about the tin men of the Wizard of Oz genre. We're not even talking about Hal from the movie. We're not really talking about robots because they are, to a certain extent, trivial. There will be robotics, there'll be devices that can do manual and dangerous things, and in a sense, that's not really that having great impact on how we're thinking. Instead, thinking again of invasive technology, are we going to start to challenge the boundary between, just as we challenge the boundary between the real world and the cyber world, between silicon and carbon, between what makes you the living person you are with your flesh and muscle and bone, and silicon systems. Traditionally, these are kept separate, but what I'd like to show you now is why we can't make that assumption. This is a rather a fun little diagram from someone called Ian Pearson at British Telecom, and I put it up just to sort of summarise his fear. As you see, we start 1.5 million years ago. This is a human evolution with Homo habilis. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. Homo habilis, our ancestors who used tools, giving rise to Homo erectus, our ancestors who stood up. And then there was a bit of a kind of a branch line dying out here of the Neanderthals, we've all heard of those, in favour of Homo sapiens, that's us, up to the present day. And then look what Ian Pearson predicts, Homo sapiens Ludditus. Oh dear, here we are. Here we are, look at us, we're going to become extinct if we don't embrace the technology in favour of Homo machinus. Homo hybridus isn't even done very well either. So, robotus multitudinus, all he says, and this is obviously tongue-in-cheek, all within 200 years. But clearly that's not going to be 200 years, and I'm sure this won't happen. But I think it does nonetheless focus our minds onto this notion, why should we think that our bodies will be inviolate to technology? Because already they are not. Already things are happening. Let's look here. This is from an astonishing experiment, the study of Peter Fromherz in Germany. And you can see here human nerve cells, for those of you who are not familiar with what they are, the blobby bits here, here they are, and the process is amazingly growing on an integrated circuit. Now, why this is really astonishing is that the silicon and carbon systems work very well together. For those of you who are biologists, this might not be surprising because you'll know that nerve cells work by generating little voltages, little blips of electricity. They are brilliant electronic components, because they've had the whole of evolution to become so. And here they are, not being part of conscious computers or anything like that, but merely being pressed into service as very versatile electronic components, working very well with the silicon systems. So we could imagine already a new type of computer, a neurochip. How would that work? Let's see what that would be. Well, here you have a circuit with the little picket fences, and here, like Day of the Triffids, like Monster, here you have a cell. That's a nerve cell. Amazing, splodging. And it's interfacing with the picket fences, as we've seen. So if you look down on it now, this is what you'd see. Here's one such. Here's a cell flanked by the picket fences. And can you see there's a whole array? And they've started to hook up them with themselves automatically, like a rather lovely filigree arrangement. This is already happening. This is a neurochip. So you can imagine in the future, perhaps your children or grandchildren will use hybrid-type computers that are part carbon, part silicon, which is quite amazing. And then we could go on. If you can put brains on chips in this way, can you put chips in the brain? And I wouldn't set up the question if the answer was no. So does that mean that this is going to happen? Here we all are, here on the left, working on our email, looking a bit miserable. Working on email, and here is someone who's had an implant, and the email is being sent in directly. They seem to have lost their body, of course. I don't know. They're in the process in this diagram, and they're smiling, but still. I don't think anyone would want the spam being fed in like this. And again, violating the firewall. Now, this, of course, I say of course, won't happen. No one is going to volunteer for major brain surgery to have email sent into their heads, I don't think. And even if that were possible, if physiologically it's not tenable, because although, as we'll see, you can control movements going out, think of a fan. It would be impossible to target all the areas in the brain that are relevant with just one implant in this way. But that said, we can see here there is a child with, in this case, attention deficit disorder who's got electrodes on his scalp. He hasn't had to have a brain implant. But nonetheless, what's happening is his brain waves are controlling what happens on the computer screen. This is a device for getting kids to concentrate, in that when you're concentrating, you emit, you generate certain types of rhythms of EEG, of brain patterns, and the devices are such that it will only be driven when that particular pattern is there. So this gets a kid to concentrate more than otherwise. It's one of those devices. So we already are playing around, if you like, with that notion. So here we are, the future with robots, synthetic processes to heighten senses and improve performance. We're already familiar with cochlear implants and artificial retinas now are even coming into view. But in future, perhaps we will have processes that can even heighten performance and heighten the senses more than just supplement any deficiency. This is giving rise to a rather scary new idea, which you might have heard of, called transhumanism. Propounded by people like Ray Kurzweil in the States, where you're using these convergent technologies to improve your performance both mentally and physically. This, of course, is freighted with ethical issues and problems, worries about the differentiation of one group of people from another, queries about why one would want to do that in the first place. But nonetheless, people are discussing it increasingly. It's something you may have heard of. If you haven't, I predict you'll be hearing about this increasingly in the future. Psychokinesis, I don't really mean some sort of conjurer's trick, but merely the fact that people now can will. There's a paralyzed patient at Emory University who's received an implant into his brain that's hooked up so that he can will a cursor to move on a computer screen. So that would be possible in the future also. And if you can have active thought, if you can have electrodes hooked up with brain cells influencing movements as you can, then perhaps soon one could influence the other two great control systems of the body, the endocrine system, that's the hormones, and the immune system, and that might be new ways of combating disease if you can harness this interface that we know exists. Look at the placebo effect that we know exists between these two systems, these three great systems. And here we are, you can wake up, red conclusion, a blurred distinction between mental and physical, between objective and subjective. If we have devices within the brain, again, breaching the firewall, we are starting to manipulate thoughts in a way that we haven't in the past. We're starting to have a physical basis, a physiological basis for the thinking process and hence its manipulation. Okay, let's move on to work. What are we going to do with our time? Well, you might think, well, in the future, one thinks again of the old idea of the future, where you have the robot doing the cleaning and so on, and you think you don't have to work anymore. But it's not quite as simple as that, because it seems that we like to work. And before, in the middle of the 20th century, unions used to bargain for shorter working time, but since then, it's now that they always argue for more pay. And it seems that the productivity gains, if they were translated into time, we could have half the year off now, but we would have the living standards of 1949. And it seems that we don't want to do that, that we prefer to exchange our leisure for a better living standard, even though we have less time to enjoy it. So clearly, work means something to us. It's usually the first question many people ask each other when you meet. What do you do? Almost the first way we define ourselves. And I would suggest, I'll come on to identity later, I'll suggest that in a way, this is how we see ourselves, our identity. So where does that leave work? Well, in the future, a merging of work and home. We know that increasingly, because of IT and because of outsourcing and subcontracting, because of portfolio careers, that people will be working increasingly from home. On the one hand, this may be good for people who are not very mobile for one reason or another. On the other hand, people talk about the beehive society and the beehive world of the workplace, where one likes to be in a working community and suffer if they are not. The end of a job for life, because we're having to skill up as technology is getting ever sharper in its growth and faster. We're having to skill up. We can no longer just learn one thing and that last us for 40 years selling back to society. We need to learn all the time. So we could well be looking at the end of a job for life and the need to learn new skills as we go along. This in turn will place a great burden on people who don't have the resilience or the training to be versatile and to adapt. And indeed, we are seeing an increase in psychiatric problems. The World Health Organization predicts that the biggest illness this century, this is something really to think about, is not AIDS, it will be depression. One in four people, they predict, will be suffering from depression this century. And this is something I think we as a society collectively need to take on board. We'll be selling our services, not our time. And one marvellous thing, I suppose, will be for women who are having children, you'll be able to balance childcare and work perhaps more readily than has been the problem, been the issue so far. You heard that I did a report on women in science, and one of the biggest problems was how to balance working with childcare. And at least it means that there'll be more versatility and flexibility both throughout your career and on a daily basis, possibly for women. What I'd like to highlight with work, though, is something that really interests me and I think interests a lot of people. And I want to make now a rather strange-sounding prediction. And that is that in the future, people will be prone to taking more risks. What I'd like to do now is try and explore with you why I think that could be the case. Let's look. If you're a scientist and you want to look at risks and why people take risks and why in the future in the workplace people might, you look at caricature situations now. You look at neurological or clinical scenarios now where people are already taking more risks and try and find out what's happening in the brain and then predict what impact the new technologies will have on the brain and see if they're similar. So let's look at an example of recklessness. Now, it seems this is, as you can see, a rather simple picture of the brain. For those of you not familiar with it, this is the back of the brain, and this is the front. The area I'd like you to focus on is this area here, which is called the prefrontal cortex. Now, the reason I'm showing it to you is it seems that when this is damaged or underfunctioning in some way, people take more risks. That is not to say this is the center for risk-taking. Please don't think that. It's not the center for risk-taking. But it's when it's damaged for whatever reason, it seems to have an impact on the rest of the brain that people become more reckless. And I'd like to show you a short clip again of a Vietnam veteran who had damage to his prefrontal cortex through a shrapnel wound. He's called Michael. And you'll see how he behaves in a way that perhaps other people wouldn't behave. So let's now have a quick look at Michael and what happened to him.
X-rays revealed the shrapnel from the grenade had penetrated the front of Michael's brain.
Michael has undergone a rather dramatic transformation. Before his injury, he was a bright and very promising and assertive soldier. And subsequent to his injury, Michael became unemployable, made many mistakes in social behaviors and relations, and has to live a much more limited life now.
Demoted and eventually discharged from the army, Michael has been unable to hold down a steady job. He's now working under supervision as a hospital janitor.
I'm going to start out by giving you 10 chips. Each chip is worth 5 cents.
Dr. Jordan Grafman is trying to establish why Michael's life has fallen apart. What aspects of his mental abilities have suffered because of the damage to his frontal lobe?
8, 9, 10.
This gambling task is designed to test his ability to weigh out the likely consequences of his actions. The point of the test is to see at what stage in the game he decides to stop.
Do you want to stop or do you want to continue?
Continue.
High cards, Mike wins a chip. 10 or less, and he loses one.
Continue.
The cards are deliberately arranged to give him a good winning streak, followed by a steady round of losses. Normally, people stop while they're ahead.
Okay, so most people apparently wouldn't do that. They wouldn't give back all their chips. So this is an example of recklessness where the thrill of the gambling of the moment seems to predominate, outweigh the consequences of losing. And it seems, therefore, that you're not accessing this intuitive feedback that the rest of us would have, and you're putting a premium instead on the immediate sensations. Another group of people that do this are people with schizophrenia. This is a very famous series of four paintings showing, at least in psychiatric terms, if not artistic ones, a deterioration in the condition of 1, 2, 3, down to 4, someone's painting of a cat. But the reason I'm showing this to you is that in schizophrenia, there's not necessarily damage, physical damage to the prefrontal cortex, but it does underfunction for chemical reasons. Chemically, it's not functioning, so in that way, it could be comparable. Another group of people, interestingly enough, are people who are obese, who have this issue of high risk taking as well. Now, what could they have in common? Sleep deprivation also, which gives schizophrenia-like symptoms. My own view is that perhaps it could be an undue influence of the external environment, the thrill of the moment. So in the case of obesity, for example, it would be the sensation, the experience of eating, the taste of the food that outweighs the consequences. With schizophrenia, there is a strong premium on the sensations from the outside world. They'll see the world often in glowing, bright colours, feeling that they are invaded. The patient feels invaded by the outside world, taken over by it. So although these conditions are all very different, they do have a common factor of a premium on the moment at the expense of the consequences. Now, could that be due to perhaps the connections in the brain not working as they do normally, to somehow give you the checks and balances of the adult mind? If that were the case, what would that mean for the future? Is there any reason to think that in the future, brains will function more like that than they do at the moment? Well, we've seen that risk-taking is linked to this underfunction of the prefrontal cortex, which is due, therefore, to less networking of brain cells. We've seen that the prefrontal cortex, with underfunction and less networking, can be related to excessive reaction, possibly, to external stimulation. My own view is that there's an emphasis on sensation, and if that is the case, you don't need so much internal or neural networking. Now, we've seen in the future that if people are sitting in front of a screen, such as with Second Life, it may be, and I'll come on to this more in a minute, that they are having much more stimulation in a fast-paced way, much more premium put on the outside world than on their inside minds. And if that were the case, then the brains would adapt, because they do adapt to this, and that might mean that in the future there would be less networking in the brain and more risk-taking. Now, that's very speculative, But I would like to predict, and of course I can easily, because we're not all going to meet again in 10 years' time or 20 years' time to find out if I was right. So I can confidently say this. But it's something that we need to think about, because risk-taking is very important. It's important in jobs. Managed risk-taking is a concern of many employees, where you don't want people who are overly cautious, you don't want people who are reckless. So risk-taking is very important for the workplace in the future, and it's something we should start to think about in terms of the impact of the screen technologies on how people are.
You're listening to the Great Speeches of Vancouver on the Local Brown Bagger here on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio.
Another aspect of work, very important one, is grey power. The fact that if you can work from home and a premium is on your mental abilities and working with computers, it won't be so important that you're not as physically fit as you used to be, or you're not particularly strong. And it could well be that rather than playing bingo here, this lady has a heroic number of bingo cards, that she actually does something useful to society rather than playing bingo. She could actually be using her abilities there for everyone's benefit. So, and also, I don't know about here, but the British government have already latched onto this and are talking about raising the pension age, and I'm sure they'll soon be saying it's good for you to carry on working, any day now. So the future of work, there'll be a merging of work and home, end of a job for life, you'll sell your services, not your time, take more risks, and we'll see a greying workforce. In fact, I was in Edmonton discussing just this issue in a superb conference called The Greying Nation, which some of you may have heard about. And here we are, conclusion. Work will no longer be a separate component of our daily existence, because if you're doing it all your life and you're doing it from home, it will be woven into your life in a way perhaps that in the 20th century it wasn't. Okay, reproduction. Now, again, I'd like to reiterate the health warning here. Some of these technologies might seem repugnant to you, and I do apologise. I hope they're not going to offend you too much. But they are there, and I'd be failing in my duty to you if I didn't show them to you. I'm not necessarily endorsing them, but we have to unflinchingly look at them. We can't just ignore them or be ostrich-like and pretend they'll go away. We do need to think about them and whether we want them and how much we want them. What we need to do if we're thinking about reproduction and how we're thinking of life is inevitably think about DNA and genes. And this is, here we are, DNA. And can anyone see good housekeeping trapped inside there? Or being witty? Or being kind? And yet if you read some of the papers, you often hear about the gene for this or the gene for that, as though trapped inside a gene was the ability to have a complex mental trait. Let's look and see how that really isn't the case. And I'm going to use an analogy of a self-opening umbrella. You might wonder why I'm suddenly doing this. I really want to show you that just because something is necessary doesn't mean to say it's sufficient, and that's the analogy I want to use with genes. But let's look at the self-opening umbrella, a Rube Goldberg device, reading from left to right, which shows how when rain falls, an umbrella will open automatically. You don't need to use your hands, but there is a high price to pay. You have this. So let's see how it works. So rain falls on a prune. There we go. And the prune swirls and pushes down a lever, which pushes down a flint lighter, which lights a candle, which boils water in a kettle. The kettle starts to boil, and steam causes a whistle to blow, which consequently scares a monkey, who jumps on a swing, and the swing rocks backwards and forwards, and there's a knife attached to the swing, and the knife cuts a string which is anchoring a balloon, and the balloon rises in the air. The balloon is attached to cage doors. The cage doors open. Little birds fly out. The little birds are attached to the umbrella. Umbrella opens! Ah, so this is Rube Goldberg, not me. Anyway, say the monkey wasn't scared, or say the little birds weren't frightened, or didn't want to fly out. Clearly, even though the rain fell, the umbrella wouldn't open. So just because something is necessary, and of course genes are necessary for brain function, right, for everything. They make proteins that are essential for brain function. But that doesn't mean to say that's all there is and that's all there needs to be. Other things can happen. And I want to give you a very good example of that, a seemingly counterexample, with where, unlike anywhere else in the brain, you can link one bad condition to one rogue gene. And you'll think that that was the end of it. But even here, that is not the case. Okay, so this is a healthy brain. Well, it's not healthy anymore. The person has died, but they weren't dead. And you can see the ears would have been either side. And I'd like to focus your attention on this area here, adjacent to these so-called ventricles, naturally occurring cavities in the brain formed as your brain grows in the womb. And if you compare this brain with this one, you'll see that these ventricles are much enlarged due to the loss of tissue here. Now, this is a brain from someone who had Huntington's chorea, which I'm sure you've heard of. Korea, after the Greek for dance, because the patient presents with wild involuntary flinging of the limbs in a grotesque form of dancing. And the reason I'm telling you about Huntington's chorea is because it maps to one bad gene, one. So you think if you have the gene, then you're going to get Huntington's chorea. Now, even here, the link is not as direct as you might think. And this is an astonishing paper by Vandellen et al., published in Nature in 2000, showing that even here, nurture, the environment, can intervene and trump your genetic destiny. The experiment was done on mice, so-called transgenic mice, who deliberately had their gene tweaked, so they had the murine equivalent of Huntington's chorea. And you could even, because it was a movement problem, wasn't a sophisticated mental one, you could quantify, measure with certain tests, how the mice were performing. The higher the score, the worse the movement. So what happened in this experiment was the experimenters, Vandellen et al., compared animals kept in so-called standard housing, simple lab conditions, with so-called enriched environment. Now, an enriched environment doesn't mean to say the mice were taken out for a fine meal or off to the Caribbean for a holiday or anything like this. Enriched means that they were allowed to interact with little ladders and wheels. So they were genetically identical. One group, simple environment. The other group, an enriched environment. Even though all of them were doomed to get Huntington's chorea. Let's see what happened. Okay, so first you can see, as always, the so-called control group, the animals that did not have the genetic modification. Not surprisingly, you can see here on the horizontal scale their age against their score. The worse the score, the higher. The worse the movement, the higher the score. And you can see, of course, they're not moving badly at all for their lives. They don't have Huntington's chorea. Unlike these, who are in the standard housing, and as you can see, as they are aging, as they're getting older, they're living out their genetic destiny, their score's getting worse. What about, though, the group that were the same as these ones genetically, but had had an environmental stimulation? This is them. Yeah, so you can see the age of onset is much later, and the degree of impairment is much more modest. Now, if this happens with a mouse with a single gene disorder merely exposed to ladders and wheels, how much more complex for you and the interaction between your genes and the environment? I'm not to say, I want to reiterate again and again, of course genes are important, but we are misled very often by the popular press into thinking that you have one gene, one protein, one disorder, or one function. So that sometimes people think that they could do this kind of thing. Here we are, choosing a life partner by looking at their genes, and here's someone optimistically wanting humour, dependability, understanding, and conversation skills. We all know those don't exist in one person. Or perhaps they do in Canadian people, I don't know. Certainly in British people, they don't all come together. Yeah. There's a rather strange idea you could do that. Or you want to do that with children in reproduction. Yeah. You can't select out in that way. There is no one-to-one relationship between a single gene and a complex mental trait. And that does lead people into a lot of misguided ideas when they're thinking about the future of reproduction. For example, with artificial chromosomes, this will enable people, these are kind of coat hangers to introduce more genes without contaminating others. People think they can put in new genes, you know, the sort of upgrade, rather like you upgrade your computer. You have the anti-TB gene or the anti-obesity gene or the, you know, anti-housekeeping gene or something like that, you know, and just sort of bolt these things on. And become a wonderful person. I mean, it's not really going to be like that. Easier access to genes, that is going to be possible up to a point, but we know with diseases like cystic fibrosis, that was a problem, because although the gene was discovered, its modification wasn't. But now there's clever ways that genes can be accessed, which may change medication, but it's not going to help us. Just because we can cure cystic fibrosis does not mean to say we can make everyone witty. It's a very different thing. Artificial or surrogate wombs, people are considering. And therefore, finally, when we get to reproduction, finally being able to extract genetic material from any cell of the body, combining it with someone else's, with IVF, so that you could have anyone of any age or sexual orientation as reproductive. And that would lead to the end of a traditional life narrative. It would mean that, for example, and this is, I'm afraid, the bit that you might find rather strange, the idea that a child could have six parents, the two genetic donors, the donor of the egg, the loner of the womb, and the people that brought up the child, and they wouldn't have to be the same people. Moreover, if people are sexually reproductive, reproductive at any age, then the normal markers by which we work out our life narrative of being children, parents, grandparents might be again blurred. I'm not recommending these ideas, but they are perhaps leading in that direction. There's a very good book called The Future of Sex by someone called Baker, which is about these various scenarios. Okay, so let's move on to education. What are we going to need to learn? Okay, well, the wonderful thing about being born a human being, as opposed to, say, a goldfish, is that you are an individual. I started off this talk talking about what makes you so special and how you're different from the person next to you. Let's think about that for a while. Let's think about why you're different from a goldfish, because goldfish are not well known for their individuality, are they? They're not well known for their great personalities. Let me press forward my attack on goldfish further. If your children or grandchildren had a goldfish and the goldfish were to die, you could sneak off to the pet shop, buy another goldfish, and the kid wouldn't know any difference, would it? Let's be honest. It wouldn't know any difference. Whereas you couldn't do that with a cat or dog, and much as they might want you to, you couldn't do it with their brothers or sisters. And that is because as the brain becomes more sophisticated, you shift from the narrow repertoire, the genetic dictates of instinct, into an interaction with the environment where you're learning experiences. And the more individual experiences you have, guess what? You become an individual. And this is what human beings do better than anything else in the animal kingdom. It's why we occupy more ecological niches than any other species on the planet. Not because we run fast or we're not particularly strong, we don't smell particularly well, but what we do brilliantly is learn. We do that better than any other species. And that's enabled us to adapt all the time. It also means we have very lengthy childhoods, but it also means that even if you are a clone, that's to say an identical twin, you will have a unique personality, as twins often will claim they have. And this is the reason. This is how you started off life. There's a newborn, 3 months, 15 months, and 24-month-old brain. The blobby bits are brain cells, and the stringy bits are the connections. And you can see that although you're born with pretty much all the brain cells you'll ever have, it is the growth of connections between brain cells that accounts for the growth of the human brain after birth, way bigger than a chimp's. Now, why that is so wonderful is because you have this postnatal growth of brain connections. You have, unlike other species, the opportunity for experience to mold and drive those connections. We call this in neuroscience plasticity. And this does not mean your brain is plastic. It means your brain is highly dynamic. And this, if you take home any message at all, take home this. This is the root of your individuality, of what makes you the unique individual you are. Let me give you one or two very simple examples of neuronal plasticity. I'm sure many people here play the piano, but many don't. And in this experiment, there were three groups of adult human volunteers, none of whom could play the piano. A 5-day experiment, divided into three groups. Here's the reference. What you're looking at here are brain scans over the 5-day period of these three groups of people. Let's start with the control group. As always, poor old controls get the boring things to do, the short end of the straw. And as you can see, they just had to stare at a piano for 5 days. The brain was remarkably unimpressed by that, as you can see. Literally unimpressed. However, these guys up here, who learned 5-finger piano exercises, look what happened. Even over 5 days, there's only a few hour sessions a day, can you see the big change that's happened in the brain territory relating, the functional brain territory relating to their digits? But even more exciting, and I'd love to address the philosophers on this one, look at these guys. They merely imagined they were playing the piano. So imagining doing something is having the same effect on the brain as actually doing it. I gather golf is the same. You can imagine you're playing golf and then you're better at it. Yeah? But it also means, again, this really shoots down that old dreary distinction of mental versus physical. I get so fed up with people that dismiss the kind of work I do as the sort of biological squalor of the real brain. Because everything you think and feel leaves its mark literally on your brain. And it's all due to these wonderful connections. These blobby bits are the brain cells. You have 100 billion of those. And the connections converge on the brain cells up to 100,000 a minute. 100,000 a cell. So that if you were to count them at 1 a second, it would take you 32 million years, even in the outer layer of the brain alone, to count them all. So you have an astonishing number of connections in your brain. And let's see again how the environment is driving that. And this time we have to go back again to the rats, the rodents, this time rats, adult rats, again an isolated environment, humane but on their own, the enriched environment interacting with ladders and wheels. And let's look at a single brain cell from each of those groups. At first glance, they look the same, but look very carefully. The blobby bit is the main part of the cell. That's there in both of them. But can you see a big difference? In the isolated environment, the branches are much, much sparser than in the enriched environment. Living in an interactive, stimulating environment has made more branches grow on the brain cells. Now, why is that important? Well, bear in mind I said that you have up to 100,000 connections on 21 cell. It follows the greater the surface area of the cell, the more connections you can make. So by living in an enriched interactive environment, you have increased the potential to make more connections. If you don't have that, you can't make the connections. So you can see a direct physical link between a stimulating environment, the growth of these branches, and the ability to make connections. Why is making connections important? Well, let's go back to our own brains. You can see here the embryo, fetal, postnatal and mature brain cell, where what's happening is the growth again of these branches. As you are growing, you have the ability to make more connections. And then in the case of senescence and senility, and I should stress this is not a natural consequence of aging, it is not a natural consequence of aging, but if it happens, you could interpret it as the dismantling of those connections. So this is a way one is actually, in the case of dementia, recapitulating childhood. You're born into a booming, buzzing confusion, in the words of William James, where you evaluate the world in terms of how sweet, how fast, how cold, how bright, and you start then to have those sensations come together, and like your mother's face or an object that features all the time in your life, rather like the piano playing. If it's again and again and again, it will drive the connections, make them stronger, and we will say that face or that object means something to you. Appreciation of seeing one thing in terms of another, I would call understanding. The same as significance would be the personalized configuration of your neuronal connections. Now, sadly in Alzheimer's, when that's dismantled, you can see how the person travels back in time, travels back through their life narrative, goes back, retreats into the booming, buzzing confusion, bereft as it is of all the checks and balances of the adult mind. On the one hand, you can enjoy sensations like children can, but on the other hand, and you've lost your cynicism possibly, but on the other hand, you are more frightened, you're more disorientated, you're more confused because you don't understand anymore what's happening. And that could be the basis of dementia. So, for example, I couldn't resist putting this in. Here's me, surrounded by six white men in suits and ties. As deliberately chosen because that's, you know, most men at Oxford University are like this. The whole point, they won't mean anything to you, but they will mean a lot to me because I work with them. So I'm sure you could substitute equal faces in for you. Yeah. So the whole point is that these are physically not very remarkable, so they wouldn't have kind of impinged on your senses in any way, but only cognitively if they'd featured in your life. So in answer to the question, what is a mind, it is not some airy-fairy alternative to the physical brain. I think it has a scientific basis. You're born with almost 100 billion neurons. The growth of the connections between the cells accounts for the growth of the brain after birth. And they, as we've seen, reflect your experience. So what does that mean then for education, given this huge vulnerability and yet potential of the brain? Well, this little girl is doing something that we all did. We, all of us in this room, were born in the 20th century. And we all grew up reading books. We all grew up playing with boxes and cars, sorry, boxes that became cars, where we were using our imagination. And without sounding too much like a Luddite, far from it, because I want to harness the technologies, I think we need to now question the impact of the Second Life world, of the screen world that we've been looking at, of these new changes in the blurred distinctions in the compartments of our lives on young people, on how they're thinking and how they're feeling. Kids nowadays spend up to 6 hours a day in the Western world on a screen, and if you count multitasking, it extends to even more. And imagine, instead of reading a book, you're exposed to this. Imagine doing that for 6 hours. what that would do to your connections, possibly. And I'm not saying it's good or bad, but it's something that we do need to address. You may be familiar with this book. If not, I do commend it to you, which actually promotes the screen culture. It actually analyses what skills children will be developing by actually working with the screen. It actually might explain something called the Flynn effect, which some of you may have heard of, which is a really interesting shift in IQ. You can see here IQ, which of course, as you all know, is a test where 100% is the average, and where, here we go, 1932 people scoring here were called intellectually deficient, whereas these people, the 113 over, were very superior. And now, if one looks in 1997, the shift, so that the proportions now, so I'll just go back, the proportions now, that means a quarter of us are very superior now, according to the Flynn effect. Now, he thinks that this may be because of the increased use of computer technologies. On the other hand, he himself argues, and I would suggest, that this is not giving you understanding or creativity or imagination or any of the other issues that you might prize. One could start to think about, and I think we should, whether people of the screen will be different from people of the book. And this is a wonderful quote from a journalist called Kevin Kelly, which I think summarizes it. Screen culture is a world of constant flux, of endless sound bites, of quick cuts and half-baked ideas, a flow of gossip tidbits, of news headlines and floating first impressions. Notions don't stand alone, but are massively interlinked to everything else. And truth is not delivered by authors and authorities, but it is assembled by the audience. So you who read books, what happened when you read those books and were being educated? The author took you on a journey. It might not have been a journey you liked or that you agreed with in the long term, but it had a beginning, a middle, and an end. It had quasi-logical consecutive steps. You then went on another journey, and another, and another, and another. And gradually, as you went on these journeys, you were able to compare them and build up a conceptual framework which enabled you to go on more journeys and evaluate more what was happening. And that is what I call education for me. Reading lots of books, comparing all the journeys, building up and constantly modifying your conceptual framework. Now imagine you haven't had that. Imagine you've been parked in front of a screen saying yuck and wow and yuck and wow, and there's a premium on the fast-moving sensations. What questions are you going to ask? Where are you going to navigate? Where are you going to go with your search engines? It's not that they're bad, it's just if you're not helped, you don't know what you're doing, you're living in an answer-rich but question-poor environment, whereas most of us were brought up in the other way around, and I think that has to be taken on board. Here's our apparently new Prime Minister, and I think that these are some questions. Certainly we did a debate on this in the House of Lords. I did a debate last April. If anyone really would like to read about this, you can see it in British Hansard, or I could send you a copy. But these are the questions I think we need to all ask. What are these new influences on our children? We haven't touched in this talk on cannabis or Ritalin, but we've touched a little bit on the screen culture. More importantly, where is the evidence on how they affect the way we think? We really don't know. If I was a parent or a grandparent, I would want to know how many hours in front of a screen changes what abilities, offset by what influences, for good or bad, at what age. I'd like to know those things, and I think we should as a society in order to design 21st century education. What do we want our children to learn? Again, to equip them for the 21st century. We can't make them into Luddites. Of course, we're going to harness the technologies. They're going to live in a very fast-paced world. We've just seen the kind of world they're going to live in. What skills must we give them to help them do that and to shape society as we want it? And once we've decided that, how are we going to deliver it with the technologies and the economics that we have? And these are questions not just for politicians and certainly not just for scientists. They're questions for the whole of society. It's why perhaps this room is full tonight, because this is the kind of thing that you feel in the back of your mind we need to ask. This is a shameless plug for the work we do in Oxford on this issue. And if you'd like to look at our website, that's it. And you can see the sort of things that we're doing in the UK. So the future then, what does it hold? These are now a conclusion. We're coming towards the end. And this is a conclusion to each of the sections. So I haven't cheated here. There's no sleight of hand. This is just the red conclusions rewritten. Emerging of the cyber world with reality. That's information technology. Emerging of the self with the outside world through nanoscience. Emerging of mental and physical, of objective and subjective. This is a new branch of science called neurotechnology. Emerging of generations, as we've seen, biotechnology. And all this will amount, as we've just seen, emerging of the past and the future into a constant here and now experience, possibly, where you don't have the narrative of your life story. You don't have your body versus the outside world. You don't have a past or a future. You don't have different generations. You just have now and experiences now. Yuck, wow, yuck, wow. Just one possibility. This is summarised in the shameless plug for my book, which I gather is not available in bookshops in Canada. But you can buy it on Amazon at $8.99. I don't know what it is in dollars, but it is on Amazon. Finally then, briefly, human nature. Can I have 5 minutes, Chairman, on human nature, yeah? Human nature, we use it a lot, but it's a very tricksy term. By saying human, we're disenfranchising most of the animal kingdom. But by saying nature, we're invoking something that is ubiquitous in time and space. So whatever human nature is, it's something that chimps don't do, and it's something that will be recognizable in ancient Greeks or Amazonian rainforest Indians. So what could it be, this human nature? It's something that was puzzling me a lot. For the first 700,000 years, perhaps it could change whatever it is. Perhaps it's what I hinted at the beginning. My own view is it's your identity. My own view, and I'll happily defend this in the Q&A, is that no other animal has the strong sense of a life narrative and of identity as we do. A feeling of uniqueness, a feeling, a presage of your own death, your own birth, and a sense of a journey going through life, evolving as a unique individual. But this identity that I hinted at the beginning that was so precious, could that vanish in this yuck and wow environment? We could call that, if you like, the nobody scenario. Now, the nobody scenario, you'll be healthy, you might even be happy, but you won't be you. You'll just be having sensations all the time. You'll have no individuality, no fulfillment. What's the other options? Well, there's the someone scenario. Here we are. Here is someone again. Now, sadly, we're not as creative as George Bernard Shaw. And most of our ways of being someone have been to own things. There was someone called Bernays, Freud's nephew, who realized that people would buy things because it said something about them, not because it needed them. And nowadays, even we have the sofa that's as individual as you are, the kitchen that says something about you. And then you find your neighbour's got the same kitchen. And you have to up the ante. You have a sort of arms race onto being individual. And all of us, you know, get our trainers to try and show how rich we are or how successful we are. And we use symbols because we are a very symbolic species. We think metaphorically, unlike any other species. That's part of human nature. But sadly, it's all gone wrong. It leads to depression, and I say this arms race. So although on the one hand, it's a gesture at individuality, we're not fulfilled in this way. And I think we're now realizing this at the end of the 20th century. There's a certain disillusionment with just unfettered consumerism. What could be the other? Well, there's the anyone scenario. And when I say fundamentalism, I mean any strong ideology of any type, not necessarily religious ideology, political ideology, it could be just as well, cultural ideologies, anything, any cult movement, where you are constrained in the way you act, eat, think, talk, and live most of your life. And in those cases, collectively, people do feel fulfilled, but they are not so individual. They are living out a collective identity, not an individual one, which, again, many people wouldn't see as what they really wanted. So no one, someone, and anyone, none of these offer a very attractive, to my mind, prospect. Could there be a fourth alternative? Is this a sunrise or a sunset? Well, I think I'd like to end with my thinking, yes, I think there could be. I'm not going to say, no, there's not. I think there is. There could be a wonderful alternative, and that's shown up here. We've all known, although we can't be creative like George Bernard Shaw, we've all known that fabulous insight you get sometimes. Those of you who are scientists will know suddenly you see something a different way. And as someone once said, science is seeing what everyone else can see but thinking what no one else has thought. You don't have to be a scientist. Sometimes you can just get insight into a social situation or political or literature. You suddenly see a connection. You suddenly, reading two books, see an idea emerge, exemplified by two very different novels or two very different things. And that wonderful insight, which everyone, I'm sure, has felt, none of us have it enough, but we all love it, you feel highly fulfilled, very excited, and you feel this is your apotheosis. And for me, this creativity, and I don't literally mean making pots or painting, although that'd be wonderful if you can do that, but that wonderful insight of seeing a new connection, being creative in that way, for me, is the apotheosis of the individual. And I think that if we could harness the technologies that we've seen in this lifestyle where we have so many shifting compartments and standards and life is going to change very radically, if nonetheless we could forge from this an individuality and respect individuality and diversity in others founded on creativity, then we could have a very exciting future for you, your children and your grandchildren. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Baroness Susan Greenfield speaking on the subject Tomorrow's People for the Vancouver Institute. Google Vancouver Institute to find out more about this fine lecture series. This was recorded for CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver.